Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Newman, a host on this channel. Today, we'll be speaking with Nara Melanish, professor of history at Barnard College, and we'll be talking to her about her new book, Paternity, The Elusive Quest for the Father, published by Harvard University Press. Nara, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
So to begin, could you tell us a little bit about your scholarly trajectory and how you came to this project?
Sure. So this book is a book about paternity, as the title would suggest, and it takes a global view of thinking about the history of paternity and ideas about the father in the 20th century. So it includes, and I did research on, and in Latin America, but its scope is broader. So I deal in the book also with certain countries in Europe, as well as the United States. And so thinking about my trajectory, my first book was about the history of family in 19th century Chile, and it inspired a lot of questions about ideas about family and practices of family and how they might have changed in the 20th century. So that book ended in the 1930s, basically. And so after I got finished with that book, I thought about writing about family in the 20th century. And so I started to do that in a Latin America focused project, but quickly got sidetracked, I would say, by what became ultimately this book. So in thinking about my trajectory, I moved from the 19th century into the 20th and from Chile to sort of a more global, in a kind of national focused history to a more transnational history. So my two monographs are really dealing with very similar questions and issues about the construction of family, about the nature of family law, about ideas specifically about paternity, and about how those ideas about paternity relate to broader social structures. But the scope is different, as is the kind of time frame.
So in your early chapters, you talk about this notion of paternal uncertainty. And you kind of describe the move toward what you call modern paternity. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by those two phrases?
Sure. So there's a kind of fetishization in, I would say, law and social theory and social practice of paternal uncertainty historically. And by paternal uncertainty, I refer to the idea that the father is always uncertain, right? The mother, it can always be discerned because of pregnancy and birth. So there was physical proof of the mother, of maternity. But paternity is always uncertain. Paternity is based on presumption. It's based on inference, right? But we have no biological proof of the father. And that idea has been kind of repeated ad nauseum for really millennia. I mean, you can find it in Roman law and you can find it in, you know, 19th century social theory, and you can find it even repeated in the 20th century. So this idea that the father is somehow inherently uncertain is one that kind of wends its way through social theory, through law, through literature, and kind of broad social ideas historically. And I argue a couple of things in the book. One is that the whole idea of paternal uncertainty is really a social construct, and that there is no real biological truth to that notion that paternity can never be known, at least until you have DNA. It seems to me that paternal uncertainty, that some fathers are more known than others, and that paternal uncertainty is a kind of a social idea. Take the example of the children of enslaved women who are whose fathers are slave masters. This is a classic example, and a particularly vivid one and disturbing one, of paternal uncertainty as a kind of social ideology. Of course, the children of enslaved women have biological fathers, but those fathers are understood to be unknown, unknowable, and we don't actually even want to know who they are, of course, right? Because in this particular instance, in this circumstance, paternal uncertainty is really functional to the social order and to the order of slavery, right? So we can talk about how, you know, the father is always uncertain as a biological idea, but it's really a social idea. And there have historically been certain fathers that are more uncertain than others. Again, the slave master being one, another example being fathers, colonists, right? Fathers who, men who father children among indigenous or native women and are considered to be unknown or uncertain. The children of soldiers sent abroad, another example of fathers who and paternity that's often considered to be unknown. So this idea of paternal uncertainty, to me, I mean, one of the things that I wanted to do in this book is to take on that idea, because I found that even kind of good feminist social science tends to buy this canard that the father is always uncertain, at least until DNA, and the mother is always certain. And it seems to me that we really need to challenge the notion that those statements come out of some kind of biological truth, and to recognize the social functionality of or function of those two constructions of maternity and paternity. So you asked about modern paternity and what modern paternity is. So what I argue in this book is that beginning in the 1920s, we see a new idea of paternity emerging in what I call the transatlantic world. And I can talk about that later, but essentially the scope of this book it includes Latin America, parts of Europe and the US, an area that I call the transatlantic. And I argue that this new idea of modern paternity emerges in the transatlantic. And modern paternity is a kind of shorthand that it's a term that I invented, and I'd be happy to talk about the modern part of modern paternity, because it's a term that I use very consciously. So the idea of modern paternity is that the father is a biologically defined figure that I think is actually relatively new in the 19th century. There's a law tends to understand father or paternity as a social relationship rather than a biological one. So modern paternity is new in that it treats paternity as a biological relationship or a physical relationship. Modern paternity also signals the idea that the father is not just a biological progenitor, but that he can actually be known. He is knowable. And it's specifically through science and scientific methods that he can be known. Again, that's also new from the 19th century, when the father is very often considered to be unknown. So there's a whole kind of fetishization in 19th century law in Latin America, but also elsewhere that considers the father to be not just unknown, but unknowable. So there are these wonderful and evocative phrases or observations on the part of jurists in the 19th century who say things like, Paternity is as mysterious as the source of the Nile, or Mother Nature has veiled paternity in her shroud, and we humans can never look behind the veil. So 19th century ideas that paternity can never be known, but modern paternity beginning in the early 20th century advances the idea that the father actually can be known, and that it's through science that we can know him. So there's this kind of spate of scientific literature that emerges beginning in the 1920s and 30s about different scientific methods for knowing the father. And some of those methods are really crazy, and I can talk about them. So modern paternity is this idea of the father as biological. Science is the way to know him. And finally, the idea that he should be known, right? That the father, that it is in the society's best interests that fathers be known, that they be revealed. Again, that's a new idea. It's not obvious in a slave society or in a colonial society that all fathers should be known, right? It might be much more functional to the social order that fathers be considered uncertain and unknowable. So this is, I would argue, this idea that the father should always be known, even when he's an unmarried father, even when he's a priest, even when he's a soldier. This, too, is a new idea. And so that's what I mean by modern paternity, that there's this kind of group of ideas, a constellation of ideas about paternity that emerge beginning in the 1920s. And those ideas emerge out of, for various reasons at that moment. And so my book explores both why those ideas come to be, as well as the impact that those ideas have, the kind of the life that modern paternity has in the century since its initial emergence. I mentioned earlier that I use the term modern paternity quite deliberately, and I want to comment on that briefly, because I know that talking about modernity or the modern is always a dangerous place to go for historians. And sometimes when I've presented my work among different groups or different audiences, I get some pushback about, you know, you modern historian, you historians of the 20th century, which I actually don't even consider myself to be, actually having worked in the 19th century, but regardless, you folks that work on the modern period love to posit this kind of clear and clean break between what you're working on and what you observe to be true and some unspecified pre-modern past. So why are you using this term modern paternity? And aren't you, you know, asserting novelty where there is none? I would argue that I think that the ideas that I am, that I find this particular constellation of ideas, while no one of them is entirely new, it's, you know, it is true that, you know, early modern forensic doctors were some of them at least, were interested in finding a physical proof of paternity. So it's not that every one of these, you know, the dimensions of modern paternity is entirely new and unprecedented. But watching how scientists and jurists and the press and publics talk about this constellation of ideas with particular interest at this time, I think is new. And I also use the term modern paternity to signal not just what I am saying about their ideas of paternity, but about how the historical actors and actresses themselves understood these ideas. They understood their idea of paternity to be distinctly modern. They posited their understanding of paternity as being distinct from, radically distinct from, notions of paternity of the past. So they love to dwell on how historically it was, traditionally in the human past, it was impossible to know the father. But today, thanks to the work of modern science, we are becoming, you know, we're getting closer and closer to knowing who the father is, to being able to identify the father. So the way modernity is central to the way that the historical actors themselves frame their actions and their understanding. So I use the term modern paternity to signal that idea or that framing of the issue. So what else? Go ahead.
Thank you. So let's think about this idea of modern paternity in a particular place. And I wonder if you can talk to us a bit about the role of Brazil, or what's going on in Brazil for this early blood testing that happens kind of as this idea of modern paternity is emerging.
Yeah, great question. So there are a whole bunch of different crazy technologies that emerge beginning in the 1920s. in an attempt to find paternity on the body. That is to say, to examine the body of the man and his putative child, and to try to find somewhere on that body the mark of kinship that will, you know, sort of reveal this relationship that has been heretofore hidden. And so scientists try a lot of different techniques for doing that. And in fact, the way that this project was originally born, no pun intended, is when I stumbled on some medical legal treatises from the 1930s and 40s by Brazilian, but also Venezuelan and Argentine scientists who proposed different methods of knowing the father. And some of those methods included using fingerprinting, which was obviously used for individual identity, but fingerprinting has a hereditary element. And so there was an attempt on the part in particular of Argentine scientists to use fingerprinting as a paternity test. There was an attempt to use dental records. There was a famous Brazilian dentist in the 1940s who became well known in São Paulo for his dental tests. There were, you know, anthropometric kinds of analyses of resemblance, etc. But one of, and indeed perhaps the most common technique was hereditary blood group testing. So we know that the blood groups, the ABO blood groups, are inherited, right? Are passed on according to Mendelian laws from parent to child. And so there was the discovery that ABO blood groups were indeed followed these hereditary rules. And that discovery was made in the 1910s, by about 1920 or so. Scientists are increasingly clear that there are these four blood types, that they are universal, that they follow these universal laws, and that therefore you can predict if you know, for example, the blood type of a child and its mother, you can predict what the blood type of the father had to be. So in the 1920s, scientists around the world become increasingly interested in using this technique in order to, as a kind of paternity test, a very rudimentary paternity test. Of course, ABO blood typing can't tell you or positively identify who the father of a given child is. What it can do is exclude certain impossible fathers, right? So if you know the blood type of the mother and the child, you know, by definition, depending on what those blood types are, that the father must belong to certain blood groups and can't belong to others. So one can imagine certain scenarios where that might be a helpful piece of information. So one of the arguments that I make is that even as scientists are very excited about early blood testing, they actually use these tests, this new technology, this new technique, in radically different ways in different parts of the world. So in Germany, for example, we see people using blood groups in child support cases. Child support cases are quite common in Germany. Germany has, at least by European standards, pretty high illegitimacy rates. There are lots of children born out of marriage, again, relative to the rest of Europe in the 1920s. And so Germany and then Austria become very interested in using these blood this blood group technique in the court to test the veracity of women's paternity claims. But what I find in Brazil is a radically different use of these blood tests. And in fact, Brazil is, as far as I can tell, the first country in not just in Latin America, but in the Western Hemisphere, to develop to adopt blood group tests in a legal setting. And so I find very early on, 1926, 1927, just a very short time after the blood, these tests are adopted in Germany and Austria, they are put into use in Brazil. And in particular, they begin in a forensic institute, the Instituto Oscar Freire in São Paulo, which is affiliated with the University of São Paulo and is still in existence today. It's a forensic science institute, one of, you know, many centers of forensic science in Latin America. The local court in São Paulo, a local judge, asks the good medico legistas, the forensic scientists of the Oscar Freire, to perform a blood test in a case in the court. Interestingly, though, that's the case is not a paternity case per se. It's not a child support case as in Germany or Austria. It's actually a rape case. And this it ends up being a very common use of blood group tests in Brazil in this period, and then moving into the 1930s. That blood group testing is used in the case of sexual crimes, specifically rape or the crime known as defloramento, deflowering, right? The seduction, if you will, or deflowering of a virgin, which is a specific a sexual crime. And so the idea is to use, again, the blood group test to assess the veracity of a woman's claim. In the very first case that's used in São Paulo, the very first use of the blood group test, it's an awful case, actually, of a very young girl who's, I think, 11 or 12 years old, who works as a maid in a household. And she gives birth to a baby and identifies as the father, her patron, her master, who ironically turns out to be a teacher of biology. But that's one of those many ironies one comes across in the historical record. So she accuses this man of being the father of her baby, and he is then, she takes him to court for this crime of seduction of or of defloramiento. And of course, the only thing that a blood group test can show is that a man is not the father of a given child. It can never identify that man, positively identify him as the father. In this particular case, the test is inconclusive. It shows that the man is of a blood group that could be compatible with this woman and her child. So at the end of the day, it's kind of a useless piece of information other than to show that he biologically could be the father, but not that he is the father. Of course, if the test had had a different result and had shown that he was incompatible and could not be the father of the child, that would have been presumably taken as evidence that the woman, young woman, really girl in this case, was, mendacious, that she was telling a lie, and that she had falsely accused a man of being the father of her child. Of course, the logic is, there's a particular logic working there. Presumably, this man could be guilty of rape, even if he were not the father of her child. Perhaps she had another partner who fathered this child, but the guy who is being accused is nevertheless guilty. But of course, in the kind of logic of sexual morality, a young woman who had presumably had sex with more than one man could not be taken as trustworthy, and therefore the blood group test would have shown, if not the paternity of the father, it would have shown the perjury of the mother. So the blood group would have been interpreted, and indeed was in other cases interpreted, to give information about the mother, if not about the father, and specifically about the mother's, mendacity. So that was a kind of typical use in the Instituto Oscar Freire, was to use the blood group test in cases of sexual crimes. That wasn't the only use, but that was one common use. And so, the point is really how this technique, which is presumably universally known, or it has a universal logic, right? The test that Brazilians are carrying out using their, vials and petri dishes is this exact same one that the Germans are carrying out and that people in the U.S. are carrying out. But the same technique is used for radically different purposes. So it's put to different use. And so that's really one of the themes of the book, is how certain technologies travel, how the blood group test traveled across the transatlantic. And as it traveled, it was called on to solve different problems, to address different social issues. And again, in Germany, it was about child support cases. And in Brazil, it was about this idea of defloramento, or the problem of seduction. And so that's, again, one of the themes of the book, is the fundamentally kind of social nature of these scientific technologies.
So kind of taking this these ideas to look at another case, could you tell us the story of Roque Arcardini and why it's important that that story is set in Buenos Aires?
Sure. So the book in general is organized around a series of stories. And that was one that was both a narrative choice on my part and also to make the history that I was telling interesting, but it was also a kind of a choice insofar as I had such a hard time figuring out how to organize a story that moved across place and across time and across theme. And so ultimately the way that I did that was by focusing on each chapter on a particular story or anecdote, and then unpacking that anecdote to ask what the anecdote tells us, not just about paternity in that time and place, but also perhaps more broadly or comparatively, what the anecdote tells us about other times and places as well, how it sort of reveals certain themes or patterns that characterize the history of paternity across the 20th century. So the anecdote that you refer to is a famous case, a paternity suit in that happens in Buenos Aires, in kind of Belle Époque in Buenos Aires in the first two decades of the century. And it involves a wealthy man by the name of Roque Arcardini, a man of an Italian immigrant background, who becomes very wealthy. His family, you know, immigrates as penniless Piemontese artisans, and then he becomes this big landowner, very wealthy landowner. And at the time of his death in Buenos Aires around 1917 or so, Roque is living in sin, as it were, with a woman who has been his partner for a number of years. And the couple have three children together. And as soon as Roque dies, his mother and his sisters, who are still alive, file suit to protect the inheritance, to protect his property from any claims on the part of these three children. And so there ensues a very long and complicated paternity suit, in essence, or really a series of legal suits about the fate of this inheritance. Roque Arcardini's family claims, his mother and his sisters claim, that these three children do not actually belong to Roque Arcardini, and that his partner, Celestina, has created this incredible ruse in which she faked pregnancy, and this is actually a crime in criminal codes at this time, suposición de parto, that she has falsified the pregnancy and the births of these three children, so much for maternity being certain, and has produced these three children in an attempt to win Roque's love and presumably have access to his money as well. Celestina, the woman, long-time partner of Roque, perhaps not surprisingly, responds that this is a ridiculous contention, that of course these three children belong to both her and Roque, and that they are therefore entitled to receive half of his inheritance as his natural children. So one of the interesting, this kind of inheritance suit, I know we don't have statistics about how many paternity suits there are in Buenos Aires at this time, but certainly contemporaries at the time worried that paternity suits were very common. They worried that wealthy men's property was being constantly assaulted as soon as they died. Children would appear, supposed putative children would appear requesting their inheritance. And so I argue that this concern about these, grasping, illegitimate children that appear out of the woodwork or appear as mushrooms, in the words of one contemporary, that this preoccupation with these children and with the threat that they pose to wealthy men's property is really a function of a moment in Argentina of great wealth, but also increasingly limited social mobility. It's a moment when Argentine society is changing radically. Cities are growing and kind of the social fabric is changing and social relations are becoming increasingly anonymous. And so Roque Arcardini's family, his mother and sisters, hire a local anthropologist. And they ask him to examine the three children and attempt to determine whether they are, in fact, the children, the biological children of Roque Arcardini. And so the chapter, my chapter revolves around this inheritance dispute, as well as this new figure of the scientist, the physical anthropologist, who is invited in to assess this claim of paternity. Again, in the past, paternity was understood as a social relationship. So the way to know whether Roque Arcardini was the father of these children was to look at his behavior. Did he act like the father? Did he think he was the father? How did he act like he was the father? What were his behaviors during his lifetime that indicated his understanding of, his consciousness of, and his acceptance of his paternity of these three children? And so there's a voluminous judicial record in which Celestina and her lawyers try to show precisely that Roque had, you know, he acted like a father. They produced letters that he would write about the children, these solicitous paternal letters that he would write about the children and their health and are they doing okay and are they eating okay to Celestina as evidence of his paternity. But introducing the scientist into the picture suggests a very different understanding of paternity. An understanding of paternity is biological, right? It doesn't matter what Roque Arcardini thought. It doesn't matter how he acted. What matters is whether he was the biological progenitor of these children. That's the conceit of introducing a scientist into the case, into the judicial investigation, to determine whether or not that he's the father. And that's a new idea. That's an idea that really departs from Argentine and Latin American law historically, which again treated the father as a social figure rather than a biological one. So the kind of contention of the scientist is that where once upon a time in, you know, kind of small scale provincial Argentine society, everyone would have known who was related to whom. In a little village, you know, that kind of social knowledge circulated widely. It would have been obvious who the father of a given illegitimate child was. But in the big city, in you know, a city that is growing by leaps and bounds, such as Buenos Aires did at the end of the 19th century and the first decades of the 20th century, in a society increasingly that's increasingly heterogeneous, right, that incorporates many immigrants, the problem of anonymity arises. So for the scientist who's called in to perform this this examination of the children and of Arcardini, that's really what's at stake. The old laws about the social performance of paternity worked in a small-scale society of villages, but they don't work in the big, modern, anonymous city. And now we need some other kind of proof to establish relatedness between people. And so that new method of proof is going to be a scientific one, according to the scientist. So, spoiler alert, how does the case end? I don't know if I should say, because then you won't want to read it. But in essence, I guess I won't tell you. But the scientist determines, I'll say this, that the three children are not related to Roque Arcardini. And that that Celestina has presumably indeed created these suppositious births and, foisted these fake children onto the Arcardini family. This is the conclusion of the scientist. I guess I'll say that you have to read the chapter to find out what the court says. Mm-hmm. So that's the scientist's verdict. And then I, again, won't reveal how the court ultimately resolves this case. But what the case really reveals are these competing ideas of older social ideas of paternity with newer biological and scientific ones. And the particular, it's kind of, I argue, no it is not coincidental that this tension becomes particularly manifest in a city like Buenos Aires that is, again, growing and changing so rapidly. There's this kind of sense that the modern city, modern society requires modern methods for discerning relatedness and discerning kinship.
Well, thank you for that tantalizing piece of the very exciting story. So you'll have to read to find out more. I'd like to go back to the Instituto Oscar Freire. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about the type of investigations that this institute conducted in a slightly later period, and also something about the sources that this institution produced and how you use them. There are some very interesting visuals in that chapter, which we won't be able to see on the podcast, but maybe you could tell us a little bit about them.
Sure. So I, in doing my investigation, I think it's always kind of interesting to hear how people conduct their research and find their sources. In the course of reading published primary sources by paternity testers in Brazil and elsewhere in Latin America in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, I came across repeated references to this Instituto Oscar Freire and realized it was kind of a center of producing knowledge about paternity and modern paternity in Brazil in this period. And so I looked online and discovered, yeah, Instituto Oscar Freire still exists. I found some tantalizing references in, again, published material from the time that suggested that the Instituto, as it produced its kind of its expert reports in the cases that it took on for the court. So this Instituto, as a kind of forensic science institute, performed myriad different medical legal investigations, paternity tests, of course, but also, you know, autopsies, pregnancy examinations, examinations of injuries and wounds in criminal cases, as well as in workers' compensation cases. So they produced thousands and thousands of expert reports on these different cases. And I had an inkling from reading the material produced in this time that they would take these expert reports and bind them into into kind of books. So I was in São Paulo for something else and decided to seek out the Instituto Oscar Freire. And I wrote in advance and met with a librarian of the University of São Paulo, as well as a geneticist who works at the Instituto Oscar Freire, which is, again, still a functioning medical legal research and institute to this day. And when I got there, they said, oh, yeah, we have some old, books in the bookshelves of our upstairs in the hallway of our institute. Go have a look. So I pull out some of these books, and sure enough, they are exactly what I was looking for, which is to say the bound copies of the expert reports that were produced by the Instituto. And so if somebody's looking for a dissertation topic out there, they're a phenomenal source. Tons of worker compensation cases, as I mentioned before, in which workers come to the Institute, workers from these, the burgeoning industry of São Paulo, and they show up with all kinds of awful workplace accidents, being maimed limbs, et cetera. And they're examined by the Instituto's doctors. And among those many, many expert reports, I found the cases of paternity suits. And so as it turned out, the Instituto began with the simple blood group test that I mentioned from the 1920s. But as time went on, their paternity investigations became increasingly elaborate. So when they were called by the court to establish or investigate the paternity of a given man, again, in the context of a defloramiento seduction suit, or sometimes in the case of a child support suit, or maybe an inheritance suit, they brought the mother, the child, and the putative father into the institute, and then performed on them a quite elaborate examination in an attempt to establish kinship between the man and the child. And so this consisted, again, of the blood group test, but it also consisted of an analysis of the threesome's fingerprints. It consisted of anthropometric analysis, examining, you know, the head shape and size and body type of the threesome, the mother, child, and putative father. And so often these investigations or these reports are quite long and elaborate. In addition to describing as a text and in, you know, the measurements of their investigations, the Instituto also took voluminous photographs of its subjects. And so the paternity investigations include these quite extraordinary kind of family portraits, if you will, of mother, child, and putative father. And they are photographs that are taken following the conventions of Bertillonnage. Bertillon's, the famous 19th century French anthropometrist, inventor of the mugshot. The photographs follow the conventions of a mugshot. So you have these photographs of mother, father, and child taken looking directly at the camera and then in profile. Again, very evocative of the modern mugshot. And yet they're also family portraits in a sense, or portraits that ask us to, or invite the viewer to ask whether there is a family connection, right? A kinship connection between these three individuals. So they're very evocative to me, visuals. And actually, when I was describing them to a friend of mine, who is also a Latin American historian, she said, to the way that you're describing them, they actually sound a lot like the pinturas de castas from colonial Mexico, right? These visuals of representations of a family. So of course, the mugshot, this is a modern, a visual convention, but there is a way that they really do evoke on some level the pinturas de castas, the casta paintings, which of course portray families in distress often, right? They're very, very often families in conflict. That's clearly the case in these Oscar Freire photographs as well. And there's, a questioning of the biological relationships between them. In the case of the pinturas de castas, of course, there's a whole racial narrative about, racial intermixture of a child produced of a biracial partnership. That is actually often the case with the Oscar Freire photographs as well. Mostly working class subjects of these photographs and subjects that really of these paternity investigations come from the multi-ethnic, plebe of São Paulo. And so they too invite questions about the racial character of mother, father, and child. And that's something about which the forensic scientists themselves often comment. And so these are, again, one of the sources that I was able to use. But essentially what I argue is that the Oscar Freire doctors come up with this kind of novel method for discerning paternity on the body, right? This very eclectic and novel set of methods relying on blood group testing, fingerprinting, anthropometry, et cetera. But I argue that by and large, they're really recycling 19th century methods of that are used from race science to identification science. So at the end of the day, while they're kind of using old parts to put together something new, they're drawing on again, photography, which is not new, fingerprinting, which is not by this time in the 1930s new, anthropometry, again, a 19th century scientific method. So they're kind of recycling and repurposing these 19th century methods for a new 20th century purpose, which is now not to know race per se, or to know individual identity, right? That's not the purpose here. It's to know paternity, to know kinship. So old methods, new purpose.
So the last chapters of your book are mainly set in the United States and in Europe. And they're fascinating, and I hope you'll tell us something about them. I wanted to particularly ask if you could share with us how your training and background as a Latin Americanist shaped the way that you did the research and wrote those chapters.
Yeah, so I mean, as I mentioned earlier, this book really began when I stumbled on these medical legal treatises from the 1930s and 40s. Because I was working on the Latin America project, the medical legal treatises themselves came out of, were produced in Latin America. Brazilians writing about teeth and Argentines writing about blood groups and et cetera. And so I started off with a question like, whoa, why are Latin Americans so interested in, and this is clearly, again, Latin Americans as in people from different parts of the hemisphere producing this scientific knowledge. So my initial question was, why is that? Why are they so obsessed with paternity and fixing biological paternity in the 1930s? But as I continued to do research, it became very clear to me that this was not just a Latin American phenomenon. So this wasn't a story about Latin American exceptionalism or particularly Latin American fixation on paternity. This was, in fact, a transatlantic phenomenon, that people in Germany and the U.S. and Italy were also really fixated on this question of the biological father and how to know him at this time. And so that changed the project radically. I realized that I didn't want to just focus on Latin America. I wanted to fold it into a broader transatlantic story. And that involved both unprecedented challenges for me as someone who does not write about, you know, Italian or German history, to, you know, kind of write chapters on those countries without being a, you know, quote unquote expert on them. But I would insist that in kind of adopting this transatlantic framework, my purpose is not to dilute Latin America. It's actually to insert Latin America into a transatlantic story and to insist on the centrality or significance of what's going on in Latin America scientifically, legally, socially at this time. And so while I don't, you know, the book is really geared towards a broad audience. So I don't spend a lot of time in the book. Maybe I'll write an article, a separate article about this, but I don't spend a lot of time thinking about this choice. Well, actually, I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. What I didn't do is write about it in the book. But, you know, one of the things the book is really trying to insist on without saying it outright is that you can't think about this topic, paternity, but by extension, probably lots of other topics in this period without thinking about Latin America's relationship to Europe and the U.S. So I find, for example, that Latin America is very much part of, and this is not just me finding this, other people have said this, but it's very clear in relation to this particular topic, that Latin America is very much part of a transatlantic conversation about science, about forensic science, about identification science, about race science in this period being about 20s, 30s, 40s. And while it's true that the conversation, that kind of transatlantic conversation is not equal, while it's true that Latin Americans spend a lot more time reading Europeans than Europeans spend reading Latin Americans, nevertheless, there is absolutely a flow of information, of ideas, of techniques, like those blood group tests that go from Germany to Latin America. There's also a flow, frankly, of people, of Jewish emigres who are fleeing Europe in the 1930s. Many of the kind of leading scientists of paternity in Europe were Jews, and so they leave. Some of them go to the U.S., particularly famous Italian serologist goes to Argentina. So there's this kind of flow of ideas and people and techniques in terms of a kind of a transatlantic scientific community. So part of what I'm trying to establish is that Latin America is very much part of that transatlantic scientific community. I also argue that it makes sense to think about Latin America in relation to Europe and the United States, as well as the reverse, for legal reasons, that these parts of the world share a common legal history and a common history of family law that helps to explain why it is that paternity becomes an obsession, a fixation in this period. And finally, I argue that this part of the world shares a kind of common understanding of kinship. And that's in some ways the most controversial, I think, claim of the three that I'm making, that there's a common scientific community, a common legal tradition, and also arguing that there's a kind of common understanding of kinship. I think that's a controversial statement as somebody who studies history of family, because there's such diversity among, you know, these different parts of the world, and nationally and subnationally, and, you know, in terms of class practices of family, et cetera. So to try and characterize this part of the world, this transatlantic, as sharing a common family culture is I think a little bit, I don't know, it leaves me open to criticism, let's put it that way. But I think that nevertheless, there is something to be said about common, if not common family practices, common norms that, you know, what Latin American elites considered or, you know, states considered to be proper families. This looks quite similar to what people understand proper families to be in other parts of the transatlantic. So there's a kind of common understanding about what families should be, what they are, even if those norms are not necessarily always achieved in these different parts of the world. So again, I'm trying to bring Latin America into this transatlantic frame, and where a lot of my earlier work has insisted on the specifically Latin American nature of Latin American family. In some ways, in this book, I'm flipping that calculus on its head and suggesting, actually, here's what Latin America shares in common with the rest of the transatlantic, as opposed to what distinguishes it as different. So I think that's a running tension in the book about difference versus similarity, convergence versus divergence. And I find that there, you know, we start off with these common ideas of law, common scientific practices, common notions of what a family is supposed to be. But then I also go on to show how it's also a story of divergence, about how paternity science looks really different and is used for the very different purposes in German child support cases versus Brazilian seduction cases. So ultimately, maybe the weight then shifts back to a story about divergence and difference and local specificity as opposed to some common transatlantic story. But there's, I think, a tension there. And so my purpose, you know, is to kind of show what it looks like to write about convergence and divergence, similarity as well as difference, and to do so again with a transatlantic frame that puts Latin America firmly in the conversation, where I think, you know, European historians, North American historians do comparative work on the US and Western Europe, but they almost never look at Latin America, of course. And so I felt very strongly about insisting as a Latin Americanist that Latin America also be at the table, because it really was in the history. When you look at the history, Latin American scientists, Latin American jurists, the Latin American press, Latin American publics were very interested in these questions. So I wanted them to be central to my history.
I think that Latin Americanists and those who study other regions will certainly find a lot to think about with this book. So I wanted to, as sort of a last question for you, so we don't take up too much of your time. This book is really about predecessors or forerunners to our contemporary DNA paternity tests, although you do talk about them at the very end of the book. So I wondered if you could say something about the insights that this history could give us to help us understand, for example, the use of DNA tests to ascertain kinship among migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border today.
Yeah, so this book is in many ways a prehistory that helps or tries to explain what happens after the 1980s, when DNA fingerprinting for the first time can establish the father with a 99.99% certainty. So in many ways, my history is about a history of failed methods, partial methods, imperfect methods, most with a few quite extraordinary exceptions of of shining hubris, most scientists recognize that while they're getting closer to understanding who the Father is, they don't really ever get there. They never find the Holy Grail, the key that unlocks the secret of kinship for most of the 20th century. So I really focus on the beginning of the story in the 1910s, 1920s, moving into the 1950s, because that's really when I see the kind of heyday of modern paternity, these ideas being established and worked out. So during that period, nobody finds the Holy Grail that can find, identify the biological father. That really only happens in the 1980s with DNA fingerprinting. So in the epilogue, I take up, that history of DNA and what happens and how the preceding, century of history that I tell, or maybe not entire century, but half century, that I narrate, how it, gives us insight into the DNA present. I talk about that in the epilogue of the book. One of the uses of DNA that I think is important that the kind of historical antecedents I discuss in the book has to do with the application of genetic technologies and kinship technologies, as I call them, in immigration and citizenship settings. So, of course, the obvious place to want to use genetic science to establish the father is in a child support case or an inheritance case or perhaps even a deflowering case as in Brazil, right? In the context, broadly speaking, of family law, of sexual crimes, etc. But immigration and citizenship law also rely on family and family relations, in particular ideas about family. And so genetic science has long been of interest to immigration authorities. And the reason that family, I should say, is of interest to immigration authorities is because family is a central category of immigration law, right? Family reunification is a central conceit of family law in a lot of different places in the U.S., but also in other places. So that, say, refugees can ask to be reunited with their family members who are resident in the United States. So there's a scenario in which immigration authorities would want to be able to establish whether the kinship claim is indeed, can be established or not. So it's really beginning in the 1950s that immigration authorities in the U.S. Start using, again, pretty rudimentary blood group tests to test claims of would-be migrants seeking to reunite with their relatives in the U.S. So fast forward to the present and to your question about the DNA present, we see, in fact, DNA becoming increasingly, its use expanding in immigration and citizenship settings in the present day to test family claims. And the kind of the most recent and I would argue egregious example of that is happening at the border, the U.S.-Mexico border. Today, literally within the past month, the Department of Homeland Security has announced a pilot program to use a special machine that can test the DNA and establish a kinship claim within just a few hours, 90 minutes. So they have these new machines that can test DNA very quickly. They're portable machines. They can be brought right to, say, Customs and Border Protection station, right? You don't have to send a cheek swab off to a lab and wait for weeks to get the result. You can do it right there on the spot. And so this rapid DNA pilot program is being applied specifically to Central American migrants. As we know, there's been a large influx of families and family units from Central America in, recent years, and especially in the last couple of months. And one of the claims, of course, of the Trump administration is that these are fake families, that people are, trafficking children across the border because they are unlikely to be detained if they come with children in tow. And so the purpose of this rapid DNA pilot program is to test families and establish whether family units coming across the border are in fact really families, or whether they're just adults with who have strategically borrowed someone else's children to make it across the border. And so I have thought about that scenario and what the history of the use of genetic technologies tells us. I would argue, and this is, of course, this is what historians always say, this use is not new, that immigration officials in the U.S. at least have been doing this for the better part of a century, using genetic technologies to test families, migrant families. And I also argue that this use is really kind of pernicious. What in essence it does is establish a kind of dichotomous understanding of family in which for migrants, the only families that count are biological families and biological ties. Whereas, you know, for citizen families, we can accept that, you know, kinship is social, that, you know, adoptive children are, you know, no less children than biological children, et cetera. But what, you know, testing DNA at the border does is impose a, you know, biological definition of a strict biological definition of kinship on families. The only family, quote unquote, that counts is the family between a biological parent, progenitor, and its child. Any other permutation or combination, an adopted child, a foster child, a niece, a nephew, would not count, right? And so I am certain that the U.S. administration is going to come up with a few choice examples of negative results from the rapid DNA test. And then it's going to go and make, you know, go to the press and say, you see, we told you these were fake families, and they'll probably have, you know, a sample of, you know, two cases out of thousands, but that will get lost in the hullabaloo, and they will make a claim that, you know, about fake families at the border on the basis of this DNA information. But again, I would argue that use of DNA or you know, biological testing really undermines social definitions of family, other kinds of parent-child relations, such as adoptive, you know, or foster children, et cetera. So I find this really pernicious. Indeed, the history of genetic tests in to establish kinship in immigration settings is really a quite pernicious history. It's really a history that's not interested in relatedness so much as exclusion, perhaps not surprisingly. So that's the kind of, I guess, the tail end, the postscript to my book. And, you know, I will not be surprised to see new, additional new uses of DNA to establish, you know, relatedness or family in different settings. But this is where the border is, I think, really the next kind of frontier, problematically. For the uses of these technologies.
Nara, thank you so much for telling us about this very timely work. Again, we've been speaking with Nara Milanic, who's professor of history at Barnard College, about her book, Paternity, the Elusive Quest for the Father. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.